From the studios of KUSP in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Mark Elliott returns to From the Bookshelf this week. Mark Elliott is a chronicler of Hollywood, telling the history of the film industry through a series of biographies of the stars and filmmakers. His books on film include biographies of Walt Disney, Ronald Reagan, Cary Grant, Clint Eastwood, and Steve McQueen. He's also a rock historian, having written the brilliant biography of Phil Oakes, Death of a Rebel, and he has written about the Eagles, Springsteen, and Paul Simon. His latest book is Nicholson, a biography. That's Jack Nicholson, of course. Mark Elliott, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
It's good to be back. Thank you.
Now, in this book, you talk quite a bit about the films of the 1970s, an era that's been called the second golden age of Hollywood, the new Hollywood. And Nicholson really thrived in that environment. What was going on in film that created that era?
Well, it really begins in the 50s and 60s when the studios began to collapse. The collapse of the studios can really be attributed to two things. First, the 1948 Supreme Court decision that separated the studios' three major streams. There was production, distribution, and exhibition. The major studios had a lock on that, which prevented independent films really from getting distribution. And that was kind of ended by this 1948 Supreme Court decision that said that the studio system was a monopoly. And then the second thing that happened was the blacklist. And the blacklist led to a lot of people, a lot of talented people in the film industry coming back to the East Coast to work on Broadway and on television, which in the 50s was still mainly coming from the East. So by the time the 50s ended, the studio system could no longer support itself. Most of the movie theaters had become separated from the studios. That gave rise to an opportunity for independent film to be expanded and to be distributed. And, of course, one of the major distributors or filmmakers who got distribution was Roger Corman. And Roger Corman, who made so many interesting and fun films, discovered Jack Nicholson. Jack was working at MGM in the mid-50s in the animation department, not as a creative worker, but he was taking acting lessons at the same time. And when Corman was getting more and more into independent films, he decided that he should take acting lessons to learn what acting was about to make his films better. So he happened to be in the same acting class that Jack was in and was looking to cast a film called The Crybaby Killer, and saw Jack and said, you know, this guy, this is what I'm looking for. This is the kind of actor who could play a psychotic killer, still with some degree of attraction and warmth. So he approached Jack, and Jack, of course, said, sure. And that's the beginning of Jack Nicholson's career, and also the beginning of independent films that got seen in America. Jack worked for Corman for, I think, 19 films, 18 or 19 films, and really got nowhere. Did the horror films, did the motorcycle films, did some writing for Corman. But Corman really didn't see Jack as star material. He saw him as independent, offbeat, a little bit crazy. That was where he put Jack. And for the bigger stars of his films, particularly the motorcycle films, he liked Peter Fonda and Bruce Dern. So they all worked together. Jack worked with these people, wrote a couple of motorcycle films for Corman, but couldn't make the break, couldn't make the big break. Then Peter Fonda and Dennis Hopper, who also were involved with Corman, decided that they could make a better motorcycle film. They thought that Corman missed the essence of what motorcycle films could be. So they got together and they went to another independent house that was working with Columbia Pictures, and they said, we'd like to get a film produced here. And Columbia said, okay, we'll give it a shot. And that film was Easy Rider. When they showed it to the studio heads, they said, we hate this film, but we don't want to release it. It's the worst thing we've ever seen in our lives. But it went to the Cannes Film Festival, and interestingly, the only person who the festival noticed and gave a standing ovation to was Jack Nicholson. Nicholson wasn't even supposed to be in the film. His role was originally given to Rip Torn, the role of Hansen, the Texan, who gets brutally killed in the middle of the film. Rip Torn, a really wonderful actor, had a fight with Dennis Hopper outside of a little restaurant in New York City while they were working on the script. He, Fonda, and Rip Torn were working on the script. Torn and Dennis Hopper got into a fist fight outside of Serendipity 3, and Torn quit the film. So they were stuck. They were days away from shooting, and they said, who can we get? And somebody suggested, well, what about Jack Nicholson? He's been hanging around our studios and our offices. And Fonda said, sure, Jack is great for the part. But Dennis Hopper said, he's not from Texas. He's a New Jersey guy. How could he play this role? Fonda said, don't worry about it. We'll play some Lyndon Johnson tapes for him. He'll pick up the accent. And that's what Jack did. He studied Lyndon Johnson's speech pattern and eventually adopted it to his own. And that's what you hear in Easy Rider. You hear Jack Nicholson impersonating LBJ. And, of course, that's the film that made him a star, an overnight star after 20 years of independent filmmaking.
And that film, Mark Elliott, also is kind of opened the door for this new Hollywood era.
That's right. It was a surprise success. It was a gift to Columbia. Corman could have had it. Corman actually turned down the film because the two producers who made it wanted too much money for it. They wanted $250,000. But the success of that film led to Five Easy Pieces, another huge independent success for Jack, King of Marvin Gardens, less so. But out of that comes Mean Streets, the Martin Scorsese film, and really the opportunity for Francis Coppola to do The Godfather at Paramount. All of these studios suddenly wanted not independent films, but films that looked like independent films. Films that were made by producers and directors who had cut their teeth in the independent movement. Of course, Coppola made, I think it was The Rain People, which was an independent film. Scorsese had done Who's That Knocking before Mean Streets, which was an independent film. Peter Bogdanovich had done Targets for Roger Corman. And that led to The Last Picture Show, which was really made as an independent feature would be made, although it was made for studio. So the door was really opened by Corman, and Jack Nicholson is really the first independent film star to become a mainstream Hollywood movie star.
It's interesting, too, because your previous subjects, Steve McQueen, Clint Eastwood, and also people like Bruce Dern, contemporaries of of Jack Nicholson, all had to play a lot of roles on TV. They all had to kind of break in through television. Nicholson never had a phase where he appeared on Gunsmoke and Alfred Hitchcock Presents and all that stuff.
He didn't do that, but he did have to do a little TV because he was broke. and he was married and had a child, and he just, you know, by the time he made Easy Rider, he was about to quit filmmaking in favor of script writing. He just couldn't. He was over 30. He didn't think that it was going to happen for him, and he was ready to get out of film. The same two producers who made Easy Rider also made Head a year before, and that was a film version, supposedly, of the TV show
The Monkees.
The Monkees.
Yeah.
That they had created.
I heard that they called the movie Head so that they could say if they ever made a sequel, from the people who gave you Head.
Exactly. and Head was supposed to be what the Monkees really wanted to be, but never could. You know, they were a manufactured band. They weren't allowed to record their own songs. They could sing on them. But the TV show became so homogenized and so not what any of the creators wanted that when they did Head, they wanted to do what the Monkees was originally supposed to be, which was an American version of A Hard Day's Night. They were supposed to be a Beatle-type, goofy filmmaking band. And they finally, when they made Head, they finally got closer to what they wanted. The only problem was Head was a total disaster at the box office. Nobody had any interest in seeing this band after their TV show. And what a lot of people don't know is that Jack wrote the screenplay for Head. And that's really his beginning to the next step of his career, which was Easy Rider. But during all of that, he did several episodes of the Andy Griffith Show.
Really?
that a lot of people don't know. And the reason he did it was he needed the money. He just needed the money, and that's also why after Jack made it with Easy Rider, he vowed never to do any TV of any sort, not even tribute shows or award shows. The only one he did really was the AFI tribute to him and something for Roger Corman. But you never see Jack to this day on shows like The Tonight Show or Letterman or The Today Show. He just will not go on television because he felt that television was a totally humiliating experience for him and against everything he stood for. So that stands to this day. You don't see Jack on TV.
We're talking with Mark Elliott, and his latest biography is a book about Jack Nicholson. Excuse me. I think not only would people who've seen Head be surprised to know that Jack Nicholson wrote the screenplay, but I think they'd be surprised that there was a screenplay for that picture.
Well, believe it or not, there was a screenplay, but so much of it was improvised and went off script. They really didn't know what they wanted to do. They had money from the producers. They had the Monkees. Jack had this, you know, Jack in his early days was one of the users of LSD. He did it with his first wife, and she encouraged him so that they could open up their relationship and be more honest with each other and whatever people told each other when they wanted to take acid. And this film was made not long after that, and you can see in it the effects of what acid did to Jack's screenwriting. He had written a couple of scripts for Roger Corman, and for a brief period of time he lived I think with Bruce Dern and one or two other actors. They all shared a house in Hollywood when they were struggling. They all worked for Corman, and they all paid their dues. But there's a scene in the book where this house that they shared was considered the biggest party house in Hollywood, I guess, before the Eagles. And everybody was partying it up, all these, you know, post-beatnik actors who wanted to be James Dean, who wanted to be the next Marlon Brando. These were their collective heroes. And girls and drugs and drinking. And there's a scene in the book where they're all partying, and Bruce Dern tries to find Jack, and Jack is in his bedroom, locked with the door locked, working on a manuscript. So it's an interesting image, because while the others who were partying and having a great time and talking about being dedicated to filmmaking, Jack is alone in the room actually pounding out a script. So this is a guy who paid his dues, worked hard, put a lot of years in before he had that accidental discovery that became Easy Rider.
You know, if you look at a picture like The Godfather, for instance, it's not, I mean, it's a wonderful picture, and it's a definitely a different kind of movie than had been made previous, but it's also not that far removed from the kinds of movies that Hollywood had been making for, you know, 70 years. But Five Easy Pieces, that movie is completely different than any movie that had been made before, except maybe independent films by John Cassavetes or whatever. That's a movie where, you know, there's no plot, there's no music under the dialogue, there's no, well, it's an odd film.
That's a film that was, or they wanted, after Jack became successful from Easy Rider, they wanted a film that could showcase Jack as the star of Easy Rider, because he only has really about 10 or 15 minutes worth of acting, and then he gets killed. So they were looking for something to showcase him. And this film really was the perfect showcase for Jack. It really gave you such an insight into his ability to play those types of characters. It was a unique film, and it wasn't as big a hit financially as Easy Rider, but it did well enough to establish Jack as a star, as an actor in his own right who could carry a film.
It's a great film, I think, but do you think it holds up as well? I mean, you mentioned Head, and that Head was, you know, kind of a reaction to LSD. And if you were on LSD when you were watching it, you probably thought it was a pretty good picture. Five Easy Pieces, I don't think audiences today would have any idea what that would respond to the film the way audiences did then.
Well, I think Five Easy Pieces is a legitimately great movie. It was written by a woman that Jack knew. She wrote it under the name Adrienne Joyce, but her real name was Carol Eastman. Carol Eastman had quite a career in Hollywood. She met Jack in that same acting class. She went on to do The Fortune and a couple of other films for Jack, and also for Warren Beatty. But in Five Easy Pieces, the film was directed by Bob Rafelson. Bob Rafelson was one of the producers of Easy Rider. And Rafelson was a partner in BBS, which was the independent company that produced Easy Rider and wanted to make independent films. Bob Rafelson's partner was Bert Schneider. Schneider's father was the head of Columbia Pictures. That's how they got that deal. And why they didn't go with Roger Corman. But Five Easy Pieces is the best Roger Corman film not made by Roger Corman. In Five Easy Pieces, you have the beginning of these films that, as you say, have no strict plot, have no studio music that the studios demanded. It's really a different kind of film. It's probably the first great existential film that came out of post-studio Hollywood. And really, to me, I saw it not too long ago. It holds up as a character piece and as a mood piece. It has, you know, it has the great Karen Black in it, who plays his country girlfriend.
She's wonderful in the picture.
She's wonderful in it, and she was in love with Jack. I interviewed her for the book, and she said that if he hadn't been involved with other people, she hadn't been involved with other people, they probably would have been married. She carried a torch for him for years, did several pictures with him. But in Five Easy Pieces, this idea that a working-class hero, who Jack plays in the beginning, turns out to be an upper-class sophisticate who wants to get away from all of that and can't find the way out, it really holds together as an interesting adult film of its day. And I really like it. I think it's one of Jack's best films, actually.
Well, you know, when you write about Jack Nicholson in your book, Nicholson, Mark Elliott, you really are tracing, you know, a long period in film history. And today's films don't have that kind of cerebral quality that Five Easy Pieces or The Passenger or some of Nicholson's other great films have, or even Cuckoo's Nest. You know, I don't think they would make a film like Cuckoo's Nest now, a film that has so much talking.
They couldn't make a Cuckoo's Nest now. They almost couldn't make it then. It took them 10 years to get that film made. Kirk Douglas owned the rights to the book and did it on Broadway as a play, believing that he would then do it in the movies. But he couldn't get it produced. It was too weird for Hollywood in plain talking. And he finally gave it to his son, Michael. And Michael had to break the news to Kirk that he wasn't going to play the lead, that they were going to use this new guy, Jack Nicholson. Today, you don't have the same system that you had in the studio heyday, the golden age of Hollywood, but you do have a system of studio distribution that has developed into a partnership with independent filmmaking. And because the studios still call the shots in today's Hollywood, you get formulaic films that are aimed at a young audience. You get computer-generated movies, not just computer effects, but computer-generated. This is what we want. This is how you make money today in film. And so the creative, the kind of resurgence of creativity that came in with Jack and the early independent films of the 70s, really is gone. There's not much of it. There's some of it being done, but you'll find most of the interesting films, or the most interesting films that are being released, I find, from my own personal taste, come from Europe, from France, from the Netherlands. Not much is happening that is any good here. There are people trying, you know, the Coen brothers, people like that. But when they make these movies, there's so much involvement with the studios that they really can't quite make the movie that they want to make. Jack held out for so long. He made so many interesting films for the studios until really Batman. I mean, by the time Jack makes Batman, that whole era is gone. And there are a few films he made that were really great after that. But I think it's less a question of Jack leaving Hollywood than of Hollywood leaving Jack. And, you know, I realize that he's in his 70s now, and it's very difficult for him to make movies that attract young audiences. You know, who's Jack Nicholson? Who's that old guy? I don't want to see that. I want to go see somebody, somebody my own age in films today, somebody who I can relate to. So for Jack, what he did was so time-specific and so revolutionary that there's really no place for a young Jack Nicholson today or for the movies he made. You really have to catch films, if you can, from overseas. The French still doing great movies. I think the best film of the year for me is Blue is the Warmest Color, a film that could not be made in Hollywood and would not be made in Hollywood. And Jack represents the beginning and the end of that movement.
Well, another interesting thing about films, and Blue is the Warmest Color is quite a long film. And most films today are very long, way too long. That particular film is an exception, but and many of the films in the 70s were long, longer than had been made in the golden age of Hollywood, although Head is blessedly only 88 minutes. but today it does seem that movies are 20 to 30 minutes too long.
They seem that way because they can't sustain the period of time given to them to make the film. Back in the let's call it again the golden age, you usually had double features. So in theaters before television, so films in those days would run 80, 90 minutes the most. 2-hour films were the exception. When you get to single film evenings in a theater, you have a little bit of a leeway, but the studios want 3 or 4 playoffs per day, not 2 or 3. And when you get to longer films, you lose 1 playoff a day, and that hurts the take of the film. So films are a little longer today. They're a little more indulgent, but because audiences are so young and they're weaned on television, they really can't sit for longer films. So it's difficult to get anything made, let's say, on the order of Peter O'Toole's great...
Lawrence of Arabia.
Lawrence of Arabia. I mean, yeah. That you just don't see that anymore in films. You see films that are 2 hours long that feel 4 hours long.
Yeah, see, that's the thing. I can watch Lawrence of Arabia, and I love it.
Sure.
And I never have to get up and pee. But like watching a movie like This is 40, I think I had to pee like 6 times during that picture.
Well, This is 40 is a typical film of this generation of filmmaking. It's a kind of a goofy, immature film that passes for an adult comedy. It's a film that nobody in that film is approaching 40. They're all approaching 20, I think. It's a good film. I like it. I love Paul Rudd and I love the filmmakers. But it's a different world. That's a kind of a goofball film. Whereas Lawrence of Arabia, 5 Easy Pieces, Easy Rider,
One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Cuckoo's Nest. I mean, these are not films made for teenagers. Even Easy Rider was more of an adult film than it appeared to be. But that's the world that we live in with film today. Hollywood is a town today of demographics. It's not a town necessarily of ideas. And that results in a different wave of independent film that I think is coming in reaction to what we're seeing, but it not there yet. What independent film needs is another Jack Nicholson.
Well, Mark Elliott, it's always a pleasure to read your books. They're kind of like a gigantic jigsaw puzzle with overlapping pieces. And I really appreciate that, and I love this new book. It's called Nicholson, A Biography. Mark Elliott, thanks so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
I always enjoy it, and I always enjoy talking to you, and I hope we do it again sometime.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you had a good time, and we'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at FromTheBookshelf.com. You can subscribe to the podcast at iTunes, and you can find us on Facebook. I want to thank my guest, Mark Elliott. His latest book, Nicholson, a biography. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next week.